Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is once again about Russia's war against Ukraine. We'll look at some of the substantial recent developments and consider what could happen in the coming weeks and months. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Ruth Deyermond, senior lecturer in the Department of War Studies at King's College London, and a specialist on Russian foreign and security policy, U.S.-Russian relations, and European security. Thanks very much for joining me, Ruth.
Thank you for inviting me on.
It's great to have you on the show again. I think all those categories have to do with what we'll be talking about, European security, U.S.-Russia relations, and Russian foreign and security policy. First, let's talk about the change in U.S. policy that came to light last week. Up until now, the United States had essentially barred Ukraine from using U.S.-supplied weapons to strike targets inside Russia. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the Biden administration has now given Kyiv the green light to use U.S.-supplied weapons to target Russian forces that are attacking or preparing to attack Ukrainian forces in the Kharkiv region. Now, this comes at a time when Russia has intensified air attacks on the city of Kharkiv, about 25 kilometers from the Russian border, and about a month ago opened up a new front line by sending forces across the border north of the city of Kharkiv. Ruth, I'd like to first ask you about the mechanics of this. Essentially, what kinds of weapons can Ukraine now use? And what kinds of facilities, bases, or forces inside Russia can Ukraine now target with U.S. weapons? And I guess, what are some of the main things it still cannot use U.S.-supplied weapons to attack inside Russia?
So, as you were saying, for a long time, there was a prohibition on Ukrainian use of American-supplied weapons to attack targets inside Russia, and this was something that had been a cause of enormous concern inside Ukraine, a source of considerable friction between, and growing friction between, the United States government and the Ukrainian government, and obviously also a source of kind of unhappiness, I think, certainly unease in some parts of NATO, some other parts of NATO. And so what we saw last week was a decision by the US government, by the Biden administration, to, as you said, allow the Ukrainian armed forces to use artillery, to use anti-aircraft systems, and to use medium-range missiles to attack military targets in the Kharkiv region, or the part of Russia that's close to Kharkiv, and which is obviously being used to launch this most recent attack on that part of Ukraine. And it's something that we've seen bear fruit already. I mean, there were reports yesterday or this morning of of evidence that or claims that such weapons had been used in the last couple of days to attack a Russian missile system that was targeting Kharkiv. So this is a new development. It's obviously a very welcome development from the point of view of the Ukrainian armed forces, Ukrainian people. But it's still very limited, as you were suggesting. So there isn't a kind of wider permission to attack military targets outside this area that's being used to attack Kharkiv. So there's no permission to attack Russian forces in Russia beyond that area. And obviously there is no permission for the Ukrainian armed forces to use US weapons to attack non-military targets. So to attack things like energy infrastructure, which, as we saw over the course of the winter, was something that the Ukrainian armed forces were doing, using their own weapons, or not using American weapons. So some of these, I mean, it's very welcome news from the point of view of the Ukrainian armed forces, but at the same time, it is extremely limited, and that has, I think, that takes some of the immediate pressure off the US government in terms of the criticism that was being kind of directed at them for not allowing Ukraine to use these to use weapons inside Russia. But it still leaves a lot of areas where the restriction on the US use, or the use of US weapons, remains. So it's kind of positive for the Ukrainians, but there are these ongoing questions about, for example, military targets outside this immediate region, which could still be used, obviously, and are being used to support the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So it's yeah, I think we may well continue to see friction on this question, and possibly there may be further movement on the part of the Biden administration. It's hard to tell at this stage, but this is certainly a game changer, I think, in terms of US policy, and hopefully a significant improvement for the Ukrainian armed forces.
Okay, thanks very much, Ruth. And my second question kind of plays off that, but it's more about the significance of the U.S. Policy shift and how much of a difference it might m make, in the medium or I guess longer term. In a post shortly after news of this policy change came out, you wrote that, quote, "Delaying on this for months was a terrible, unforced foreign policy error for Biden." Unquote. And I'm just going to digress here for a minute. Unforced error. There was kind of also at the same time, around the same time, there was, I guess, what might be called a forced error in terms of the Biden administration when Congress was holding up Biden's request for tens of millions of dollars in mostly military aid for Ukraine. Now that finally went through February. But so, there are various factors, but essentially these two kind of problems were playing out, well, maybe one after the other, if not at the same time. But in terms of what you said, could you explain some of the damage you believe has been done already by not making this change much earlier? And also, I guess I would phrase my question about the potential impact, wider impact on the war this way. Clearly, the decision came long after many people who want to see Ukraine prevail, believe it should have. Given that fact and the geographical and other limits, that the United States has placed on the ability of Ukraine to use, US-supplied weapons to strike inside Russia, could it be too little too late?
So there's a great deal to talk about in all of that, obviously. I guess on the question of the error and the consequences of that, and exactly what type of damage has been done by this delay, unnecessary delay, in the sense that for months the Biden administration seemed to be dithering on whether or not to allow Ukraine to use US weapons to attack targets inside Russia, and now it's permitted that. So I guess the first issue of damage, of course, relates to Ukraine itself, that in that interim, while the Biden administration was making up its mind to allow this, of course, a lot of Ukrainians have died who might not have died had cities and villages been better protected. Had the Ukrainian armed forces been able to attack military targets, for example, in the area close to Kharkiv, that were being used to attack Ukrainian cities and villages, right? So the first area of damage, I think, somewhat the most important area of damage, is the damage done to Ukraine itself, to Ukrainian lives, Ukrainian infrastructure, the impact on Ukrainian culture of the destruction of kind of cultural sites, all of which has been ongoing and could perhaps have been limited by this decision having been taken earlier. But then there are the kind of political and diplomatic foreign policy kind of damages, which are also very serious and multiple in character, I think. So one area of damage, I think, has been to the US-Ukrainian relationship, which has clearly suffered as a result of this delay. We've heard Zelensky and those around him expressing dissatisfaction about the constraints placed on US military aid to Ukraine, which is, I think, their perception is that they're being asked, they had been asked to kind of fight with one hand tied behind their back. Clearly, success in the war in Ukraine is closely linked to the relationship between Ukraine and the US. And so, the damage to that relationship, I don't think will help the outcome of the conflict in Ukraine, the war in Ukraine. And I don't think it will help, in more general terms, in wider terms, the Ukraine-US relationship. I think it's kind of increased a degree of mistrust. But there's also, I think, a damage to perceptions about, perhaps a damage to perceptions about Ukraine's capacity to win the war, which of course had already been there, particularly since the kind of failed counter-offensive of last year. But I think the delay and the further damage that's been done to Ukraine, and the fact that Russia has been able to launch this new offensive in the Kharkiv region, all of this, I do think, contributes to a perception that Ukraine doesn't have the kind of resources to win this conflict. And that is going to put more pressure, I think, on the Ukrainian government to come to a negotiation at a point when it doesn't feel that it would be in Ukraine's interest to do so. So I think that's damaging. But then for the US itself, I think there are a whole series of kind of damaging consequences for this delay. I think it suggests that that the Biden administration is nervous about key areas of its foreign policy, that it's nervous about the consequences of allowing Ukraine to win. I mean, I think that's a strong perception in quite a lot of quarters, that the Biden administration is at least as worried about Ukraine winning as it is about Ukraine losing. And that feeds into a whole set of wider relationships, and doesn't feed in a good way. So it puts more strain, I think, on the relationship between the US and its European NATO partners, which was already kind of under some pressure, not least because of the congressional delays in voting through military aid to Ukraine, which you talked about a moment ago. And obviously, there's anxiety in Europe about the possibility of the outcome of the November election, the possibility of a return of Donald Trump, and what that would mean for US Europe relations. And so I think kind of indecision, indecisiveness by the Biden administration on Ukraine, I don't think it helps the relationship with NATO partners at a point when that relationship is already under some strain. But I also think it's very damaging for the US, for the Biden administration in particular, because it suggests kind of a degree of anxiety about the actions of other competitor states that would not be expected from, the dominant military power in the world, which the US still is. Anxiety about Russian escalation, I think, clearly drove a lot of this reluctance to allow Ukraine to use these weapons. There was also, I think, considerable, and there is still, I think, considerable anxiety in Washington and indeed elsewhere in NATO about the consequences of Ukraine decisively winning this war, the impact on Russia, and what will happen in Russia if Ukraine wins. And all of this, I think, sends a signal or reinforces a perception that the US in general and the Biden administration in particular is kind of weak on foreign policy. And that's not something, and indecisive on foreign policy. And that's really not something that I think that the US government wants as a perception of it, in the context of this war, in the context of rising tensions with China. So that's a very long answer, but for all those reasons, I think this has been an enormously damaging mistake by the US, by the Biden administration.
Well, thanks very much for that, Ruth. And I guess we'll see some of these, I guess, dynamics kind of play out or see how they're going to play out at this the peace summit coming up a little later this month in Switzerland. The relationship between the U.S. and Ukraine and the relationship between the U.S. and Europe and kind of the perceptions there. So thanks very much for that. I guess I would just follow up with a couple of questions. One, we spoke about the U.S. This U.S. decision, but I guess there have been kind of somewhat similar developments with some of the European countries in terms of what they're letting, what weapons they're letting Ukraine use for what purposes. And the other question, so if you could maybe talk about that a little bit, but the other question is, so now the US has allowed this limited use of American weapons in terms of targeting Russian territory, limited to those to Russian forces and facilities that are attacking Kharkiv region. Do you see, and obviously it's hard to predict, but do you see this as sort of opening of the gate? Is the United States liable to then expand on this kind of on this decision and allow for further broader use of its weapons by Kyiv?
It's a very good question, and those two questions I think are linked, or I'm going to link them by referring back to something that the French President Emmanuel Macron said a few weeks ago now. He talked about the fact that by which he meant NATO states, say, we can't possibly do things, or we can't possibly allow Ukraine to do certain things, and then a few weeks later we do it, or we allow it, and we keep doing this, right? I think he was talking about this in the context of questions about whether France would ever send troops to Ukraine, and he was refusing to rule it out definitively. I think clearly the change in US policy has been made in the context of, as you say, similar decisions made by partners in NATO, although a number of them got there considerably earlier than the US did, and in slightly different ways. So the UK reportedly allows Ukraine to use Storm Shadow missiles to attack military targets inside Russia. France and Germany obviously have also announced that they are going to allow, or they do allow, Ukraine to use their weapons that they supply to Ukraine, to attack targets inside Russia. So this is part of a wider shift, but certainly I think in the case of some partners, the shift was made earlier, and the restrictions on weapons use are not quite as great. On the question of whether this is going to change, then, yeah, to go back to the Macron point, it seems as if every kind of step that's taken in supporting Ukraine by the US, by its European partners, is taken after a lot of agonizing about why it can't happen, why certain things won't be allowed, and then they are allowed. So I think, given that this is something that we can see as a repeated pattern, over the last 2.25 years, it's reasonable to assume that this isn't the end of that particular road. I suppose the really big question is, at what point is this not going to be possible anymore? At what point will NATO, European NATO states, but particularly the Biden administration, decide that something is simply too dangerous to allow? Because we've seen all the way through that what's driving this kind of reluctance to allow Ukraine to use Western weapons inside Russia is anxiety about escalation on the part of Russia, but also, I think, as I said before, anxiety about what the consequences would be of really pushing Russia to a decisive military defeat. And so I think, given that there is ongoing anxiety about that, I would say, fear that a military defeat would lead to the removal of Putin and his replacement by somebody potentially worse, but also anxiety about the possible kind of collapse of Russia in this, as the Soviet Union collapsed in 91. And I have to say, I don't think either of those two things are, well, certainly the second one, I don't think is likely, but this is clearly a fear in some kind of capitals. So anxiety about that, and anxiety about escalation, I think, will continue to limit what Western states allow Ukraine to do. But I think it is likely that there will be a further relaxation of these kind of restrictions. But at some point, it's going to meet a kind of hard barrier, I suspect, where there will be simply too much concern about the potential consequences. So that's a very vague answer, I'm afraid, but we really don't know. And clearly a lot of it will depend on what happens actually on the ground in Ukraine over the next few weeks, probably. So yeah.
All right. Well, I wouldn't say that's vague at all. A very, very, very comprehensive answer. And frankly, the thanks for your comments on the on sort of the Russia, the Western or U.S. fear or concern about Ukraine winning. That could be a topic of a podcast in itself. I very much appreciate your comments, and we're going to wrap it up here. Thank you for joining me, Ruth.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Ruth Dayrmond, a senior lecturer in the Department of War Studies at King's College London, and a specialist on Russian foreign and security policy, U.S.-Russia relations, and European security. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.